economically, politically, geographically, etc.
All right, and on that note, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Glenn Deason, professor of political science, University of Southeastern Norway, out of Oslo. Greg Simmons, independent researcher and author, out of Sweden. And we appreciate you, as always, being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ribbiyyun kathir. فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا رافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثوابا حسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord. So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair. And make firm our feet, and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world, and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
South Africa hosts the 15th annual BRICS Summit as the bloc weighs the admission of new members, including Iran. West Africa's regional bloc rejects Nigerian military leader's proposal to hold elections in 3 years. Also in the headlines, North Korea warns of a nuclear war if the ongoing joint drills by the U.S. and the South involve a nuclear provocation. Good to have you with us. A bloc of five major emerging economies known as BRICS is due to convene a summit in Johannesburg later today. The South African president will host his Chinese and Brazilian counterparts, the Indian prime minister, the Russian foreign minister, as well as some 50 leaders from other countries. BRICS is expected to consider granting new memberships during a three-day summit, as over 40 countries have expressed interest in joining the bloc. They include Iran, that applied for the membership last year. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has also been invited to attend the gathering in Johannesburg. South Africa currently holds the rotating chairmanship of the group, which represents 40% of the world's population across three continents. Its members' economies also make up a quarter of the global GDP. West Africa's main regional bloc has rejected a proposal by Niger's military leaders to hold elections for the transition to a civilian rule within 3 years. The ECOWAS commissioner said the bloc wants Niger's president, Mohamed Bazoum, to be released without preconditions and constitutional order restored without further delay. Abdel Fattah Moussa's remarks came after an ECOWAS delegation visited Niger's capital and met with the deposed president and the military leader, General Tiani. ECOWAS has threatened military intervention if talks with Niger's military government fail. In a televised address on Saturday, Tiani said the country's military leaders are open to dialogue to avert a conflict with ECOWAS. However, he warned that the country is ready to defend itself in case of an act of aggression.
Nearly 1 month into a military coup in Niger, the situation remains tense there as the country grapples with political uncertainty. As part of efforts to reverse last month's coup, a delegation from West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has met with junta leader General Abdelrahman Tiani in the capital, Niamey. The delegation led by Nigeria's former military leader, Abdulsalami Abubakar, and accompanied by ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré, has also met with Nigeria's ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Although there has been no detail on the outcome of the talks, General Tiani said in a televised address that neither coup leaders nor the Nigerian people want war and remain open to dialogue.
In short, neither the military junta nor the people of Niger want war and remain open to dialogue. But let us be clear, if an aggression is launched against us, it will not be the easy ride that some people think it is. They will be up against 26 million Nigerians.
Tiani said the junta was pursuing its own agenda and would launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, which should last no longer than 3 years.
I am calling on all the living forces to engage in an inclusive national dialogue. The aim of the body dedicated to this dialogue is to consult all the components of the people of Niger on the best ways to lay the foundations of a new constitutional life on pillars deeply rooted in our traditional and republican values.
Tiani's comments and meeting of ECOWAS representatives with coup leaders and former President Bazoum come as the bloc on Friday doubled down its threat to use force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. It said an undisclosed D-Day had been agreed for possible military intervention there. This was enough reason for thousands of Nigerians to hit the streets of Niamey to throw their backing behind coup leaders.
The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many argue that efforts to reverse the July 26 coup are in line with the interests of Western countries. Thus, against the backdrop of France trying to maintain its grip on its former colony, which is now one of the biggest producers of uranium in the world, and the U.S. facing a growing pro-Russian tendency in Niger.
The developments in Niger come as coups are normally rejected by nature, no matter the time and place they take place. But the public support for the military junta does indeed convey a message. The disillusionment and dissatisfaction with the previous regime can be named as such. A desire for change and a belief that the military might bring stability or address grievances that have not been adequately addressed by the previous government is among reasons behind the public support for Niger junta leaders. But in the case of the West's stance toward Niger developments, what comes to the spotlight is Western countries' push for a military intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Are they really seeking for the establishment of a civilian rule, or are there real concerns that the persistence of a military rule would not meet the demands of people across the West African nation? Western countries claim that they are involved in a fight against terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. But taking a glimpse at West's interests in Niger proves that seeking a civilian rule in Niger for the sake of its people would be so naive. In the case of France, Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on valuable uranium reserves in Niger. After all, the French government is entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to Germany and other European countries. This makes France huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Maybe that's why, seeing its political interests in tatters, Washington is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate the pro-Western president. All what it is, the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians and they're the ones who should decide their own fate is of very high significance. Given all the anti-West hatred among the people of Niger and other nations across the Sahel region, it seems that it is for the West to stop meddling in the affairs of those countries and let the people decide their own political future.
North Korea has issued a stern warning about the possibility of a nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula. The warning followed a recent summit between the leaders of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan, as well as annual Seoul-Washington military drills that began on Monday. North Korea said agreements reached during the Friday summit were aimed at formulating a nuclear war provocation during the drills. Pyongyang said if the military exercises involved such a provocation, it would raise the possibility of a thermonuclear war on the peninsula. The North said the prevailing situation requires its military to take the initiative, including through, quote, offensive and overwhelming action for war. The three countries agreed at their Camp David summit to deepen ties in the face of China's growing power and what they described as North Korea's nuclear threats. China, for its part, has warned that the trilateral agreements could lead to regional confrontation.
I would like to say that China has taken note of the relevant reports that the parties concerned are obsessed with engaging in small circles and using the peninsula issue as an excuse to strengthen military cooperation and seek geopolitical privacy. This will only aggravate the risk of confrontation among regional camps, undermine the already fragile mutual trust of all parties, and harm the strategic and security interests of other countries.
Wenbin called on Washington, Seoul, and Tokyo to abandon what he called the Cold War mentality. He also urged them to help maintain peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula and hold talks on regional problems. Frank Smith is a correspondent who joins us from Seoul. So, Frank, what went down in that summit and what has raised the alarm for North Korea in terms of the retaliation? And what is a thermonuclear war anyways?
Well, the primary outcome of the Camp David summit with the U.S., South Korea, and Japan really isn't any different than they've been performing since Yoon Suk-yeol came to power here in South Korea and promised to strengthen its alliance with the United States, as well as reverse course on the previous president's policy of trying to engage North Korea and limit cooperation with Japan. So this development and deepening of a trilateral alliance with South Korea, the U.S., and Japan really goes against, again, the previous administration and probably about 40% of the South Korean public at least, with 20% maybe undecided, another 40% or so might support this policy. It's viewed really as provocative by North Korea, together with the joint military exercises with the United States that kicked off just on Monday. This is Ulchi Freedom Shield. It's scheduled to go on for 11 days. This military exercises are seen by North Korea as a rehearsal for invasion and generally do involve amphibious landings, as well as the deployment of so-called strategic assets. These are weapons that could potentially deliver a nuclear strike against North Korea. So it is reasonable that North Korea would bristle at this kind of behavior here.
When you take a look at the reaction coming from North Korea regarding, in this case in point, you pointed out to the 11-day military exercises, are we anticipating any type of reaction from them during the 11 days? Have they made any announcements?
Well, North Korea did announce that it was going to attempt or launch another satellite into orbit. It tried to do that back in May. That launch failed. It's viewed again by South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. as a violation of United Nations Security Council sanctions. North Korea wants to place a surveillance satellite into orbit. Again, North Korea is surveilled by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan in various ways, including satellite, to try to monitor its various launches. North Korea launched a record number of various missiles last year as it seeks to kind of close the gap with the United States. It has 30,000 troops here in South Korea. So these developments, again, serve to raise the tension and encourage North Korea, rather than seek negotiations with the U.S., South Korea, and Japan, but rather continue on its path of developing its military as Pyongyang seeks to deter this aggressive strategy from the U.S., South Korea, and Japan.
I don't know if you can answer this or not, Frank, but given all the different times that the U.S. has held military exercises with its allies there, and considering the one that's coming up, if they've outlined what they're going to do, does it point to the fact that they can prevent, if they were to attack North Korea, prevent North Korea from launching a nuclear possibility of a nuclear capable missile? I mean, is that the military outcome would be preventative, in a sense, from North Korea launching a nuclear capable missile or not?
Well, I think really we're in a circumstance of mutual assured destruction. That meaning that, well, if one side was to launch an attack against the other side, it would face an overwhelming deterrent. North Korea now has a number of different ways that it can respond to U.S. And South Korean aggression. It has cruise missiles. It has submarine-launched ballistic missiles. It hides missiles inside of tunnels that can then be taken out of those tunnels and launched. It has 10,000 artillery tubes along the DMZ that could turn the South Korean capital, Seoul, into what Pyongyang refers to as a sea of fire. It's capable of doing that within just a few hours. So for the U.S. or South Korea to launch a strike against North Korea, it would really face a devastating response. And that provides a serious deterrent. Still, you know, that threat is something that North Korea feels. And it feels that it must maintain a deterrent to prevent such an attack and such provocation.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Frank Smith from Seoul. Thank you. The Iranian foreign minister has once again condemned the recent acts of desecration of Islamic sanctities in some European countries. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a meeting with the Algerian parliament speaker, Ibrahim Boukhali. He said parliaments in Muslim countries have a role to play in countering Islamophobia and sacrilegious acts. The top diplomat also hailed an agreement between Iranian and Algerian parliament speakers to hold a virtual meeting of Muslim countries' top parliamentarians to condemn the recent insults against Islamic sanctities. Amir Abdollahian described political relations between Iran and Algeria as excellent, calling for further expansion of those relations in economic, trade, and tourism fields. The Algerian parliament speaker had earlier held talks with his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Bagher Khalibaf.
Ibrahim Boukhali, the speaker of Algeria's parliament, who has made an official visit to Tehran in a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Bagher Khalibaf, discussed bilateral, regional, and international relations during the meeting. Talking to reporters after the meeting, Khalibaf said that activating the Iran-Algeria Economic Commission is high on the agenda of talks between the two countries.
The joint Iran-Algeria Economic Commission will start working soon to prepare the ground for bolstering mutual ties in the field of economy. The expansion of the shipping lines between the two countries and cooperation in the field of science was another topic discussed in the meeting. Since Mr. Boukhali is also the head of the Islamic countries' parliaments, a virtual meeting was needed amid the desecration of the Holy Quran that has repeatedly been taking place in Europe these days. During the meeting, we emphasized that all parliaments of Islamic countries should have a serious follow-up on the acts of desecration, and all parliaments of the Islamic world should take a serious stance in this regard.
For his part, the Algerian parliament speaker said the visit was to strengthen his country's relations with brotherly countries, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, which Algerians have a lot of respect for.
We call for stepped-up economic ties between the two nations in line with political relations. Algeria has approved a new investment law that provides incentives to investors. We hope that Iran is one of the countries that could take advantage of this investment opportunity and that Iran's achievements will be developed with the lifting of sanctions. At the international level, fortunately, we are aligned with the Islamic Republic in many positions, and we hope that relations will be strengthened more and more in the near future. At the level of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, we must do better, particularly regarding actions of desecrations that are done against Muslim sanctities.
The two sides agreed to accelerate cooperation in the fields of science, technology, industry, tourism, agriculture, and medicine, stressing on the fact that history has shown Iran and Algeria are friends of hard times. Aside from holding talks with senior Iranian officials, the Algerian parliament speaker, during his five-day stay in the country, is scheduled to visit a number of Iranian knowledge-based companies to explore avenues for strengthening ties in different fields. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
And that is with this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper.
and place me among thy friends, for thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we have made you familiar with the views of British thinker Hamed Algar on Imam Khomeini. Algar, teacher of Islamic studies in Berkeley University of California, believes that the Islamic Revolution would have never triumphed without the leadership of Imam Khomeini. Today, you will get familiar more with his views on the personality of Imam Khomeini. Stay tuned, please. British University lecturer Hamed Algar writes that the first Pahlavi ruler, Reza Khan, did his best to isolate religious institutions and depreciate them among the academics. The illiterate king even made every effort to prevent holding of religious sessions all over the country. The great leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, held classes on ethics and very soon attracted a great number of seminary students and ulema. These sessions were so instructive and impressive that many ordinary people, too, took part at the classes, and even people from other cities tried to attend the classes which were held weekly. The brave confrontation of Imam Khomeini with the despotic ruler reached the point that the chief police of the holy city of Qom asked him to stop his classes. But the Imam didn't give in and answered that if the police want to stop the classes, they would have to resort to force. Unable to intimidate Imam Khomeini to give up his classes, the regime's forces tried to derange the classes. Yet, this stratagem failed too, as the Imam changed the place of classes from Faizieh School to another one. Ahmed Algar says that the outstanding point at Imam Khomeini's ethical classes was his divine motive. He believes that this point was indeed the basic characteristic of the Imam. He writes, "The divine motive was one of the notable features of Imam Khomeini, who led the revolution till victory. He always paid attention to the main source of glory, grandeur, majesty, and power. God." Algar continues that Reza Khan intended to omit Islam in Iran as a political, social, and cultural power. He writes, "This goal had been dictated to him by the imperialist powers, especially Britain, because they deemed ulema in particular and Islam in general as an obstacle for achieving their goals." The British researcher names martyr Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Modarres as Imam Khomeini's role model and writes, "No doubt, the clergyman who was the role model of a struggle against Reza Khan and put a very deep impact on Imam Khomeini was Sayyid Hassan Modarres. Modarres's opposition against despotism and the foreign hegemony regarding his simple way of living seriously impacted Imam Khomeini." Imam Khomeini considered Modarres' reaction towards Russia's ultimatum to Iran during the constitutional movement as an example of real religious behavior, so that he referred to it in various speeches, especially in his speech whereby he exposed the totally humiliating and colonialist capitulation bill, which gave legal immunity to thousands of American advisors in the case that they committed any crime in Iran. Algar writes, "Perhaps the most important narration of Modarres, which has been repeated several times by Imam Khomeini, was his opposition to the Russian ultimatum. The Russian forces had advanced up to Qazvin to add to their demands, but Modarres stood up at the parliament against any granting of concession. Imam Khomeini has commented on this. The conduct of a real religious leader must be like this. A slim and a slender man rejects the ultimatum of a powerful government like Russia." The Imam, in his historical speech in condemnation of the capitulation bill for the American criminals, has mentioned this event. Undoubtedly, in that case, he felt as his duty to resist against the arrogant hegemony of the U.S., just as Modarres had successfully stood against the demands of Russia 40 years earlier. Imam Khomeini's famous phrase, "America cannot do a damn thing," which he said after capturing the U.S. embassy, the den of espionage, had already been said by him about Modarres' measure to oppose the Russian ultimatum. The Imam had said, "The Russians cannot do a damn thing." Like his role model Modarres, he stood against the arrogance of a superpower and brought it to its knees. Dear listeners, next time we will continue with the views of Ahmed Algar on Imam Khomeini.
Thank you.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we look at a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. On this edition of the program, we will be exploring the concern by many Muslims that attempts to infiltrate and destroy our religion from the inside may be well underway, and with significant Western support as well.
A popular stereotype which Muslims living in the West are routinely branded with by the mainstream media is the concept of creeping Sharia, the idea of a great Muslim conspiracy to change the West and implement their own system of governance on an unsuspecting public. However, this conspiracy is false and is largely rooted in right-wing dehumanization of Muslims as a foreign invader. In reality, the roles are flipped. Muslim leaders and activists are raising alarm bells of establishment-backed efforts to infiltrate and change the Muslim community from within. Here are a few noteworthy examples. In Britain, huge support is given to promote and platform a group known as the Qadianis, or sometimes by their preferred name, the Ahmadiyya. The group's claims of being an Islamic sect is heavily supported by the British establishment and cemented with English news reports claiming the same. However, this group is routinely condemned by Muslims worldwide for their heretical beliefs, including a belief in prophets after the final messenger, Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Muslim world considers the Qadianis as a heretical cult backed by the British to further their imperialist interests. Their propaganda is said to cause significant damage to the Dawah, spreading false ideas under the name of Islam. For Shia Muslims, the concept of British Shia and American Sunnis has been warned against by some of the Shia world's highest authorities. Radical preachers based in the West who spread sectarian views or narratives with the purpose of sowing conflict and fitna across the Muslim world has been compared to historical imperialist tactics of divide and rule. Other examples could include the self-described Muslims who enter into secular politics, using their Muslim heritage to score votes, but endlessly contradicting Islamic principles when it counts. In some cases, these self-described Muslim politicians support policies including Western aggression on the Muslim world or that criminalize Muslims living in the West.
Well, joining us today in the studio to talk about these very concerning issues, we have two esteemed guests. Sayed Mohsen Abbas is a TV producer, broadcaster, presenter, and journalist based here in Britain. And Raza Kazim is a human rights activist, political analyst, teacher, and presenter as well. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you as always. Sayed Mohsen, I'm going to come to you first because you're very familiar with these groups that were mentioned among, those are just a few examples. Just tell us, why are they a real danger? What problems can they cause for the Ummah?
Well, first of all, I think to give it context, you have to understand the objectives of those people who are looking to use these groups against Muslims themselves. So that's primarily the neoliberal, neoconservative, Zio-Western imperialist power. That's who really stands to benefit from playing any games within the Muslim world. And they stand to gain basically the securitization of their own interests, plunder political and military in those regions. So divide and rule is a well-known old tactic, and this is no different. What you find is that once the Islamic Revolution occurred, because this is the root of the real current contemporary issue that's going on around sectarianism and these issues. So the Islamic Revolution leads to a response from Israel, from the Zionists, from, of course, the British establishment and the American establishment, which kowtows to them. And it leads to coming up with strategies like launching entire wars against them through Saddam Hussein. And cut to the chase, around 9/11, they come up with their ultimate policy to go and literally start invading every country in that region, from Iraq to Afghanistan to Libya. All of it has gone down because of, I think, their fear of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance that's rising in that region, which threatens their economic and other interests. So one of the classic tactics in soft power is to infiltrate the enemy, in this case, the Muslims for them, and to find their vulnerable points, their weaknesses. And the British especially are exceedingly good at this. They have intelligence from back in the 19th century, 18th century onwards, they've been doing this kind of thing, and they have the intel on the Muslim world. So they're the ones who I think led very much in terms of coming up with this notion of creating your own Islamic groups or favoring certain groups in order to break the natural push that was coming from the Islamic Revolution, the ideals of political autonomy, sovereignty, independence, those notions of liberty for Muslims and for them to take hold of their own lands rather than being ruled by post-colonial imperialists. This is what the real game was about. And they nurtured, for instance, Salafism, Wahhabism, that was their first game. The Saudis were initiated back in the 70s to launch a huge amount of finance into the business of sectarianizing the Muslim community. And rather latterly, of course, they've got their fingers in the pie even with the Shia communities around the world, because what they don't want is they don't want a united Shia Marjiyat under the Marjiyat, or let alone under the auspices of Ayatollah Khamenei. They don't want a kind of an Islam rising in Britain, which is truly political and wants justice and is against those kind of plunder, looting, and kind of manipulation, divide and rule policies. So, of course, what do? You go and find the most vulnerable people within the Shia communities. You offer them money. You enroll them into your sort of educational systems. Offer them career incentives. Pay direct cash, or simply find the ones who are naturally in a problem with the Islamic Revolution or the Iranian establishment, and you start buying them into your agenda. And that's exactly what's happened.
I think Mohsen mentioned very accurately that historically Britain has been known for using a divide-and-rule strategy to rule over its conquered regions as part of the empire. But the empire is actually gone now. So why is it that groups like the Qadianis, which have a huge temple, whatever you want to call it, in London, and a lot of support, other radical preachers seem to be given special status here to preach their hate in the UK. Why is Britain persisting with this strategy today when the empire as we knew it has basically crumbled now?
I think if I can quote Winston Churchill, the ex-Prime Minister of Britain, he said the empires of the future are the empires of the mind. And I think also Steve Biko, in contrast, South African activist who was killed by the apartheid regime, actually said the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to think about in terms of how things are actually going. And following on from what Mohsen has actually said in how this is playing itself out within the, when you talk about British Shiism or American British Shia Islam and American Sunni Islam, these are concepts and they're not necessarily limited to those geographical areas, although we can really see people who are within the British system actually pandering to this sectarianism. You know, what's his face, the sectarian scumbag who sits on the members, and you know, the Simon Cowell wannabe. You know, he's trying to push that kind of agenda. We also see within the American Sunni concept, even within Britain, there's some of that, where you've got Muslim news organizations platforming some of the takfiris who are allowed to do takfir against the Shia. So we've got that whole spectrum of things actually going on, which are a real problem. You've also got this idea that you've got to normalize, again, following on from what Sayyid Mohsen has said about normalizing the proponents of Zionism within the Muslim community. So that they come on the TV channels, they come on the community centers, where the opposite would not work if you had people who were going to perhaps speak up for Palestine or something like that. They wouldn't have any of that actually going on. So you've got that normalization actually taking place. The other aspect is this idea of depoliticizing Muslims, depoliticizing Muslim spaces, and depoliticizing Islamic centers, so that anything that is of sociological concern, sociopolitical concern, or political concern, where there's oppression going on, where there's racism going on, where there's injustice going on, where, as we feel that, you know, one of our concepts of Islam is this idea of having justice, fighting against oppression, standing for the oppressed, and all of those things is very central and core to who we are as Muslims. And that idea of depoliticization is something that is very much part and parcel of what's actually going on. And there is an attempt to actually social engineer what kind of Islam you would have. So the idea is not to shut down centers or Muslims, but to actually, you know, following on from what Sayyid Mohsen has said, is actually taking things in a direction that will be beneficial for the state. So you would have the buffet service that the you know, the British establishment would actually want Muslims. Okay, you can have this, this, and this, but this is not going to be part of what's available on this menu.
For sure. Now, before we cut to the next wise words of wisdom, which we're going to play out shortly, let me just very briefly ask you, Sayyid. I guess could you just list the problems? So we've got radical speakers who spread sectarian ideas. They're getting support here. We've got groups that are undermining traditional Islamic beliefs, like belief in other prophets after the prophet. And then we also have, what else? There's like politicians who represent Muslims apparently, but then they undermine Muslims. There's so many examples here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from the secular angle, there are people who would call themselves secular Muslims. So they will do anything to conform with whatever secular, neoliberal, muscular neoliberalism wants them to. They have no concern about standing up for justice or being anti-oppression. They're just happy with the pie they have living in the West and absolutely grateful for the Queen. Well, it's the King now, isn't it? And the establishment to continue giving them the abundance and plenty which keeps their mouths shut, basically. Then you've got, of course, the religious fundamentalists, as the media here likes to put it, but basically the Wahhabist Takfiris or the Qadianis, all those people in one way, shape or form all conform to this agenda of splitting and dividing. The Qadianis do it in a different way. They've always traditionally been very much tucked in as the alternative to real Islam. They were in British India, along with the Brelvis and many others, part of the movement to suppress the mutiny, suppress Indian independence when it rose up in 1857, when there was a genuine uprising. It was these kinds of forces which were all manipulated by the British as sectarian groups to praise the establishment, to suppress any notion of mutiny and revolution. So we're seeing the same thing being done again now. The same groups, the same kind of insipid brown noses of establishment coming and doing exactly what they've done historically. It's really almost, if you go and look at Indian history, you'll see all of this being played out already there.
And they're all here in the UK, coincidentally, including Yasser Habib, another hate preacher who was, I think he was jailed at one point in Kuwait. Now he's ended up here. He's got his own TV station. It seems like some coincidence, doesn't it? Let me just ask you about this specific point, the one he made about British Shia and American Sunni. He explained that, you know, he's not talking about Muslims living here. He's talking about bootlickers, essentially, Western-backed Muslims who are undermining traditional Islam, undermining the power of the Ummah, basically. So perhaps, again, you could just emphasize this point to our audience. How dangerous is this, and what danger could it have from here, even over in the Muslim world as well?
I think it's like this term that was said about Gufis who, betrayed Imam Hussein at the time of Karbala and so on and so forth. It's that same kind of idea that you've got British Shias, you've got American Sunnis, and the idea is to actually say quite clearly that you are depoliticizing, disempowering Muslims to be able to say what is the right thing to say, to stand up against oppression, to say things at the time that the British state wants you to say certain things and not say other things because the British state at that point in time doesn't want you to say those things, to encourage sectarianism within the Muslim community from both angles, from both sides, to actually promote hatred between the Muslims. So when you've got Muslims fighting amongst each other, then you will not have them fighting against the oppression and for standing for the oppressed.
That's the danger of fitna, basically. That's what this is.
Absolutely.
This is a fitna coming.
And it's something that is about social engineering, a specific type of Islam where you'll have someone who is looking like a Muslim, doing everything, you know, like Imam Khamenei said, in their personal affairs, is doing everything that a good Muslim should be doing, and yet they are disempowered from actually saying, standing up for at a community level, the concept of ummah, that we're not just individuals, we are a part of a community that is supposed to stand up for justice, and so on and so forth. And disempowering them here and abroad, and using the people here to actually influence what goes on abroad, going into those communities. We've seen there's evidence, money trails and so on, of how people have actually gone in and influenced the direction of where a Muslim community abroad is going to go and what they're actually going to do. So I think this is something that needs to be guarded against.
For sure, and I think I understand more so now, Sayyid Mohsin, about the whole concept of, you know, I can say I'm a British Muslim because I'm a Muslim living in Britain and I'm British by nationality, but to say I follow British Islam, that's really dodgy, isn't it? I mean, Islam is Islam, and I look to the Middle East and the homeland of Islam, proper scholars about this. I don't look to the British royal family who give a few occasional quotes from the Quran as if they're an authority of the British government. We have to be clear here. You know, I can be a Muslim living in Britain, but we follow Islam, and Islam comes from the Quran at the end of the day.
And not be taken in, if I can come in, with this concept that Prince Charles, as he was then, said defender of the faiths, to somehow make himself out to be in that kind of mold.
Yeah, he's no defender of my faith at all, is he?
I think that there is a very subtle trick being played. You see, the new generation that's coming up, they haven't grown up in the countries back home. They don't have the same sort of routines. Many of them don't know about the political situations in those countries either. That's the reality. And what the Western establishment is trying to do with the Muslims here is the same thing they've done with Christianity. So if you look at Christianity as a parallel to this, they've totally depoliticized Christianity. There's no fight for justice or anti-oppression movement you discernibly see coming from the church or the church establishment or any formal establishment. You'll see them cornered into doing social work or welfare work or helping people in kind of vague ways, but never to do with justice, political justice, or social justice on the big stage. So they've basically turned Christianity into a kind of a political eunuch, essentially. Yes. And so that's what they
defeated
want.
Defeated force, basically.
Basically.
Defeated force, no following.
No following of that kind, and no ability to give them the direction that they require. The Pope himself fails, let alone the Church of England. None of them have the ability or the inclination, actually, because they're all part of the same establishment. That's the reality. So the Muslims are now gradually being herded and regimented into this same process of trying to create a kind of an Islam which is conforming to British policy at every stage. And that's a problem because it will also mean that tomorrow, you know, if there's a war on Syria, and they literally did, you know, if there's a war in Afghanistan, a war in Libya, here the population is currently maybe 6 million Muslims. Another 15, 20 years, that's likely to be 15 or 20 million Muslims. So you can see from a political perspective, to have a set of Muslims who are depoliticized is hugely beneficial for the establishment.
They want to cut the ties between Muslims here and the actual Muslim world, which they're at war with basically most of the time. I think that's the point you're trying to make very, very well. Reza, let me come in because there's another example here which we have to include in the show. of where, you know, I think Muslims living in the West can sometimes betray their own community through essentially working with the establishment on, for example, there's an issue with mosques being infiltrated and having non-Muslims installed by the state to manage over them and their charity status. Fill us in on this story and this problem. Make it easy to understand if you can for our audience.
So this is something that the Islamic Human Rights Commission has taken up as a campaign about Save Our Mosques, because it is something that the British state, via the Charity Commission, is actually targeting mosques across the Muslim spectrum and taking them over in appointing interim managers and saying what can and cannot be done. This is in direct violation of the Quranic verse, which clearly states that the people that who should be maintaining the mosque should be Muslims and people who are following the Muslim faith, the principles of the Muslim faith, and so on and so forth. I'm paraphrasing that verse, and it's very clear, very very clearly stipulated that non-Muslims or people appointed by a non-Muslim institution cannot be running a mosque, because it will, whether because first of all, then they are following the agenda of a non-Muslim. They're not following the agenda that is an Islamic agenda, regardless of the sect of Islam that you belong to. And we see that whether it's whatever spectrum of the Muslim community you come from, whether it's Shia, Sunni, it's Barelvi, etc., mosques have been targeted, interim managers appointed. And it is deeply disturbing that this is going on. And one of the things that's happening is the amount of pressure that's being piled onto them. People, trustees, sometimes feel that they have to try and get the mosque open at all costs. And, you know, I'll take the example of the Islamic Center in Maida Vale, which is incidentally linked to Imam Khamenei and so on and so forth. And one of the things that has actually happened there, which is quite, that's been going over the past year, is that there have been Islamophobic attacks and racist attacks against the mosque, where it's been physically damaged. The people inside have been attacked, hurt, and some people from the Muslim community has been hospitalized as a result of the anti-Muslim hatred and rampage that took place across London and ended up at the Islamic Center, and people were had to be taken to hospital for treatment and so on. So this kind of thing was going on, and the police weren't doing their job. So people from the Muslim community who were going to this particular place, and in fact others from different parts of the Muslim community, actually came together and said, right, we're going to stand up, and if the police aren't going to defend this place, we are. And we stood together, shoulder to shoulder, and said, right, come on, come now, if you dare. And as a result of that, and us pushing back and being prepared to sacrifice, because when those thugs were going to attack, it was going to be physical attacks. We would have had to defend it physically. A lot of those people are professionals who will, as a community, would have lost millions. People who would have lost their livelihoods, people who would have gone and so on and so forth. So I think it's something that people need to recognize in the center, that there were people who were prepared to defend it. And when this takeover happened, it was an insult that the Islamic Center was being taken over by a non-Muslim. And the trustees have capitulated. They've capitulated and allowed this interim manager to run the place and have opened the place of worship instead of resisting. And this is something that is completely unacceptable, because it is against what Rehber would have wanted, and it is something that is in violation of the verse of the Quran.
Sure. It's basically a case of a mosque which the British establishment doesn't like, because it's showing independence, and they're now cracking down on it. This is a fantastically interesting story. Unfortunately, we have no time, gentlemen, but we will be talking about this in the future, I assure you, as we have done on other shows. Unfortunately, yes, that is all the time we have for this edition of the show. Thank you to our guests, and thank you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
U.S. border authorities stopped migrants entering the country illegally more than 33% more often in July than in June, suggesting lower numbers that followed the end of pandemic-related asylum restrictions may have bottomed out. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. officials along the border with Mexico processed migrants 183,503 times in July, as illegal crossings jumped by 33% after dropping to a two-year low in June, despite record-high heat levels, according to government statistics published on Friday, 18th of August. Border Patrol agents recorded 132,652 apprehensions of migrants who entered the United States unlawfully in between ports of entry in July, compared to nearly 100,000 such apprehensions in June. Moreover, U.S. immigration authorities processed 50,851 migrants at legal ports of entry, a record high, mostly under a system that allows asylum seekers in Mexico to use a phone app to request appointments to enter the United States. The sharpest increase in unlawful crossings occurred in Border Patrol's Tucson sector, a sprawling and remote region that covers most of Arizona's border with Mexico and parts of the Sonoran Desert, where temperatures have reached 110 degrees Fahrenheit every day this summer. Border Patrol recorded nearly 40,000 apprehensions there in July, a record for the sector. Border Patrol